You're listening to CJLO 1690 AM here in Montreal.
For CJLO News, I'm Nicole Celso. On Monday, January 27th, the Ministry of Education announced that the funding for the success of immigrants and the educational success of Indigenous students have been put on hold. Last December, the ministry asked the Directors General of the School Service Centers to cut 15 measures from the budget rules of 2024 and 2025. It included youth climate change projects and introduction of parliamentary democracy to high school students. Nicolas Prévost, president of the Fédération Québécoise de Direction d'Établissement d'Enseignement, disagrees with this decision. He stated that due to the on-hold funding support, certain schools with projects to promote Quebec culture won't be able to open this year. In an interview with CTV News back in November, the Auditor General of Quebec, Guylaine Leclerc, criticized the lack of support for Indigenous students. According to Guylaine, the Ministry of Education is not offering Indigenous students enough assistance to promote their success. Premier François Legault said that he never wanted to make these cuts. He also said that it is up to the school service centers to handle budgets properly. U.S. President Donald Trump's administration fired more than 10 Justice Department lawyers who worked on two criminal investigations against him. They were dismissed after acting U.S. Attorney General James McHenry said that the officials could not be trusted to faithfully enact the president's agenda because of the role they played in his prosecution. According to a copy of the termination letter seen by Reuters, McHenry justified the firings by citing Trump's power as chief executive under the Constitution. Special counsel Jack Smith, who brought forward two cases accusing Trump of national security and election-related crimes, has now dropped the charges to avoid prosecuting a sitting president. Earlier this month, Smith resigned from the department. The longtime public corruption and national security prosecutors who worked on Smith's cases remain in the department after Smith closed his investigation earlier this month. On Wednesday, January 29th, at around 9 p.m. Eastern Time, a jet carrying 60 passengers and four crew members collided with a military helicopter mid-air near Reagan Washington National Airport. The U.S. Army Black Hawk helicopter had three people on board. Around 300 responders moved to the Potomac River near the airport and arrived at the scene with inflatable rescue boats and light towers to brighten the site of the collision. However, in a press conference on Thursday morning, Chief of Washington, D.C. Fire and EMS Department John Donnelly said that the responders are now switching to a recovery mission. Donnelly said that they do not believe there are any survivors. Among the passengers on board were 14 figure skaters with their coaches and families. The flight was coming from Wichita, Kansas, where a development camp was held after the U.S. Figure Skating Championships. So far, the bodies of 27 passengers have been recovered by first responders. Investigations are still ongoing. This collision marks the first fatal U.S. jet crash since 2009. For more, go to cjlo.com/news or follow CJLO News on Spotify.
Hello, you're listening to CJLO 1690 AM, and I have a very, very special episode of Shaking the Habitual today for you. I'm going to be off the mic for the vast majority of it because I am joined in studio by my friend Claire Levesque, an Indian Quebecois artist and who I know through Women Aware, an amazing Montreal-based organization that does a ton of work around intimate partner violence. She'll be interviewing Andy Williams. Andy Williams is the host of The Magic Roundabout on CKUT, a jazz historian and a vinyl DJ, about his artistry and jazz in Montreal and the whole works. And I guess I'll just pass it over to them. Clara, take it away.
Thank you so much. Andy, thank you for being here. Welcome.
Oh, thank you.
So a little background info for some of you guys that don't know about Andy. Andy's, Cam said, jazz historian. He went to school in Derby. He's done a lot of extensive teaching over the years. He's started some really great projects such as Jazz Amnesty and Opero, among other places here in Montreal. If you have a second, I really highly recommend to give a search and a read on him. There was recently a beautiful feature article written by Vasily Vroulis in Diary of a Social Gal about him, so you can read more about him there. Andy, tell us a little bit about jazz in Montreal. I think a lot of us don't know about some of the roots and the scenes, some of the prominent figures. Who are some people that you have found inspiring or that you think people should know more about here in Montreal?
Well, actually, a lot of people do know Oscar Peterson. He's my favorite, and I'm sure that goes for thousands of people. Oliver Jones is a big one for me also. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole bunch of folks. Those are the two main ones.
And in terms of those two main ones, I remember you talking about some of the tunes that they would use in their music, and because we met through Dr. Dorothy Williams' class on Black Montreal history, and you know, what were some of the rhythms that they were using? What was so special about the music? Why is their legacy important in terms of?
Well, initially music? Montreal was more of a rhythm and blues city, and it became a jazz city later on, probably in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And it was more of a rhythm and blues city before.
Now, you do some mixing and whatnot. Do you ever, like, mix with some of Oscar's music? What's, like, your mixing habits in terms of, like, that
Nothing with Oscar, but he's definitely influenced a lot of people. Mm-hmm. It depends who you want to speak to, but he's definitely, he's been involved in a lot of different scenes.
So when you're mixing your music, what kind of influences or artists shape how you're going to evolve a piece? What does a typical DJ session look like with you?
Well, I'm a little different than other people. I tell stories with my music.
Yeah?
Yeah. So if you're listening to a funk piece, mm-hmm. You're definitely going to know where funk came from, or where the blues came from, or where Latin came from. I always make sure that I put that in the limelight.
So in terms of when you're mixing, it's not like, say, going out to a club and it's unst type of vibe. It's
But there's definitely that kind of vibe when you listen to it, because mm-hmm. I'll make sure the beats match. Like if it's 140 minutes beats per minute, the next song will be 140 beats per minute.
So it's beyond just flow and curation. It's about conversation.
That's right.
Between the records.
That's right, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. One of the big themes or big concepts that I remember reading about that I absolutely love that you talk about a lot in your work is connectivism. Now, I think a lot of people aren't privy to that, and how instrumental that can be in terms of our history to Montreal and jazz music and to ourselves. Can you talk a little bit about what connectivism is?
Yeah. It's an academia thing. Mostly, I get together with different types of professors from all over the world, mm-hmm. mostly North America, and we interact online, and that's how it started. Before COVID, before COVID, people would be talking about connectivism, because that's how people connected. It's a way of connection. It's a way of connecting.
So this is interesting, because I want to go into the field of art therapy, right? So for me, art therapy, visual arts, is about how we're all interconnected as ecosystems, and I come from a very natural eco-feminist perspective as well. So it feels like connectivism is about somewhat like that, of how we're all connected, but through sound and music and tune, and especially mm-hmm. funk.
Not just funk, the whole gamut.
The whole gamut. Yeah,
diaspora of different things.
Cool. So this is something else we've talked about before, but the Black diaspora of, like, using diverse music. So what other types of music do you incorporate or are you currently researching or looking into to incorporate more?
Well, now I'm trying to do research for a doctorate in Appalachian blues and Gullah music, which is from, it's the only preserved music from slavery. And okay. it's definitely from South Carolina, and I really want to get that across to people, so I'm going to try to do a doctorate with that.
Why do you think it's important to do research more into this, or to try and reincorporate it into music and the arts, and tell, how can we tell stories that are uplifting using this?
Well, in that sense, since you put it that way, and it brings across the music really quickly,
mm-hmm.
and people can observe or read liner notes, which is never mentioned in liner notes. Just like hip hop, hip-hop's not mentioned in liner notes, which is kind of weird.
For some of us that are not musically inclined, yeah. What are liner notes?
if you grab an LP or an album. It's the notes on an album.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Nice. I imagine, too, that because of the synergy of music, there's also that aspect of it gets people moving, it gets people in their bodies, and then because it gets people moving in their bodies and grooving, it gets people thinking about our physical connections here and now to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So, we were talking about Oscar Peterson earlier. Is there a specific song by him that you really vibe with?
Well, Hymn to Freedom is the best known track because you see it on all the commercials.
Okay.
When they show the mall on the White House, the mall,
mm-hmm.
that picture, it's an Oscar Peterson song.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
So it's well known for easily 50 years. So you can never get rid of Oscar Peterson. It's always going to be there.
Timeless and impactful on the society. Just That's like right. you and your work, and this is how, like, I think history transcends with music and influences how we connect to each other. So let's give a little listen to a little Oscar Peterson song.
Right. Thank you.
Lay production Nuit Afrique, in collaboration with TD Bank Group, presents 5 exclusive concert events from February 2nd to the 28th, highlighting roots and rhythms celebrating Black History Month. Don't miss the tribute to Tamani Djabate and the closing concert of Samba Touré, the legendary guitarist of Ali Farka Touré. Reserve your tickets now and discover the complete program at festivalnuitafrique.com.
You want some hip-hop, you want some R&B? Tune into The Limelight, 6 to 8 every Saturdays, right here on CJLO 1690 on your AM dial. That's what's up.
Hey everyone out there in Radio Land, you're listening to CJLO 1690 AM in Montreal.
And we are back. Thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in. For those of you just coming in right now, my name is Claire Levesque. I'm an artist here in Montreal, interviewing and talking with DJ Andy Williams. Andy, we were just talking earlier about Oliver Jones and the music scene here in Montreal, and jazz especially, and that you're an historian. You've got all this wealth of knowledge on the music scene, especially here and abroad. Something that I remember you talking to about and that really struck with me was Ajax Records and Rockheads. And I think a lot of people don't know about how prominent and successful these individuals were for their time, and how big of an impact it had on connecting community, especially when we were talking earlier about your idea of connectivism. Can you talk a little bit about what Rockheads was here in Montreal?
Well, Rockheads was one of the first established black clubs in Montreal back in the day. Mm-hmm. And you know, it was more than just the club scene, and it was a mixture of young kids, old kids. And it became a landmark in Montreal.
And in terms of like landmark, what kind of who was coming to Rockheads? What was it doing for the community?
Name a musician. No, seriously, like name a musician.
I don't know, Faith Nolan. No, she wasn't there. Oliver Jones.
Oliver Jones was there. Yeah, he was a kid. He was a kid back then. Yeah.
Yeah, cool. And so, who are some of your heroes that played at Rockheads that you can think of?
Fletcher Anderson. Billie Holiday. Eartha Kitt.
Oh, we love us some Eartha Kitt.
Yeah, those are the ones that come to mind right away, because those are the ones I listen to a lot. So,
and was there like dancing? Was this like a hip spot for people to just kind of chill, take it easy?
Well, there was Showgirls. Do you know about the Showgirls?
Yeah, yeah, okay. I know about the Showgirls.
All right, so there were Showgirls, their performances, early theater. Mm-hmm. Rhythm and blues, big band stuff.
So it was more than just music. It was
the place to be.
It was the place to be. It was a place to connect. It was intercultural, interarts. But also it was a place to showcase that black individuals here in Montreal were successful and were prominent.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, from my understanding, got their big break going to Rockheads.
Right.
So,
yeah,
cool.
And it was same time as Prohibition.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. So that, I think that added a little component to it. And
the booze was illegalized,
right,
around the world, and Montreal was the joint.
Yeah.
For
people to come get away.
Get away, yeah.
And Rockheads definitely served up.
One of the places, yeah.
Yeah, and in terms of Rockheads, Is it still around? Is there an homage to it?
I just did a tour with Herbie Hancock, and I couldn't even show my place. All those places now are condos.
I think that's part of what breaks my heart, and especially a lot of those areas.
If it was Toronto, they preserved the building, right? Mm-hmm. But not in Montreal.
So it seems that seems to be kind of like a lack of, in terms of heritage, prioritizing some of these historical spaces, especially Black spaces that were successful and there. But still, once we know that they existed, we can go walk, we can listen, and we can read up and whatnot.
The buildings are not there anymore.
They're not there anymore.
The last building, and they still haven't done anything with it, was the Negro Community Center.
Okay, yeah.
In Little Burgundy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just trees and weeds. And
Yeah.
And that was important for the UNIA, you know, the Marcus Garvey movement. It was important for a lot of things. And we didn't grasp on the history.
So all the community, all the history was like kind of intersecting in that area and intermingling. I think there's a lot to be said about the gentrification of that area. It's not just the housing crisis, but it's also, there's a lot of culture that's been lost through the gentrification.
And they built the expressway, the highway.
Yeah.
Which divided it all up, right?
Yeah.
Did Dorothy talk about that?
I remember her talking about that, but I'm also very privy to that, especially because that's exactly what happened. Same thing that happened there is what happened with Africville,
right.
Which is something that is very profound when I first heard about the story of Africville.
Yeah, it became a dump site.
Yeah, oh my goodness. And I think that's a big big ideal for us to see of how systemic racism has made it so that we forget the importance of these spaces, and that people tend to take these prominent Black spaces and then kind of turn them into rubble. But we don't forget, and we're resilient beings, and we make better opportunities from it. For those of you who don't know about Africville, can you give us a little brief rundown of what Africville was?
Well, before it became a dump site, it was pretty well known also for amalgamation of African Americans.
Yeah. Successful Black businesses.
Successful Black businesses. And then they decided they're going to move it and rebuild and a better spot for it.
Quote unquote.
Which they didn't.
Yeah.
And I guess people were like, oh! And so it came to nothing. It became a dump site.
Yeah. It was empty promises, from what I understood.
And there's certain areas around it that are pretty well known for Blacks, too. Hammond's Plain. Do you know Hammond's Plain?
Mm-mm.
Okay. No. So there's all these different landmarks for Blacks that were integrating themselves with other Blacks.
Okay.
So there's Blacks in Nova Scotia, Blacks in the States,
mm-hmm.
Blacks in the West Indies.
Diaspora.
Yeah, diaspora.
Yeah. One of the songs I remember getting to listen on your beautiful record that you brought in was Africville by Faith Nolan. And I think, you know,
that was hard to find. I found it.
Oh, it's a beautiful piece. And I think it encapsulates a little bit this idea, like what you were mentioning or talking about earlier, of connectivism, of using music to reflect back on history, but then to also think about how we're going to move forward from here. Because, you know, the past can give us a little bit of information on where to move forward and how to build hope and resiliency and whatnot. So how about we give a quick little listen to Africville?
It's quite folky, though, but it's okay.
Africville down in 1969. All the people just left. I wonder what happened to them. You know, the government does this thing. Spend one life living there. Now Africville's gone, she's in a
Montreal has a rich cultural history of live music dating back centuries, from the traditional folk and jazz of the early 20th century to the vibrant hip-hop, indie rock, and metal scenes of today. This legacy was not just paved by the great artists gracing the stage, but also by the legendary venues that have hosted and uplifted music scenes in Montreal through the decades. Did you know that Canada's first Black-owned nightclub was founded here in the 1930s? Rockhead's Paradise was a jazz bar owned and operated by Rufus Rockhead, a Jamaican who immigrated to Canada originally in the late 1910s with the dream of opening his own nightclub and dance hall. The venue originally opened in 1927 as a diner and a hotel in the Saint-Antoine district of Little Burgundy. However, in the early 1930s, Rufus's dream began to become reality as Rockhead's Paradise became the epicenter of Canadian jazz, attracting popular American artists during the Prohibition era by serving beer and wine. However, Rufus faced systemic racism from both the Montreal and Quebec government while trying to become licensed to serve hard liquor, neither of whom wished to grant a license to a Black person trying to own a bar. Despite the five-year fight to obtain a full liquor license, Rufus persevered and Rockhead's Paradise rebranded as a jazz cocktail lounge in 1935. The club became a fixture not only in Montreal's music scene, but also functioned as a safe haven for Black Americans and Canadians in a time of intense prejudice. Jazz legends like Nina Simone, Louis Armstrong, Billie Holiday, and Ella Fitzgerald frequented the venue when they came to Montreal and also nurtured Canadian talents like Oscar Peterson. This success continued until the early 1950s when the club closed down for nearly a decade. When Rockhead's Paradise reopened in the 1960s, jazz had greatly waned in popularity, and the previously bustling cultural hub of Saint-Antoine had begun to decay due in part to the industrialization and displacement of the borough's working-class population. Unfortunately, aside from the brief resurgence in popularity in the following decades under new ownership, and in opening up beyond jazz to other genres like R&B, soul, and funk, financial issues forced the building to close down permanently in the late 1980s. The legacy of Rockhead's Paradise lives on through Montreal's jazz scene to this day as an important part of Black Canadian history. Rufus Rockhead passed away in 1981 and was honored in 1989 with a street named after him in Little Burgundy. Rockhead's Paradise left a lasting mark on the city's jazz legacy, providing a platform for emerging Black artists who lacked other opportunities to showcase their music and making Montreal a cultural hotspot in the scene. CJLO 1690 AM, celebrating Montreal's historic venues and vibrant musical legacy.
And we are back. Thank you so much for that. Oh my gosh, I love Faith Nolan. What happened to Africville? What happened? Nah, it's so good. It's so good. For those of you folks tuning in, we are joined with Andy Williams, a jazz historian, amazing, multidisciplinary person, DJ artist here based in Montreal. We're talking about jazz, we're talking about music, we're talking about connection through ancestral roots in music, and a little bit of the history scene here. We were talking also about Ajax Records and, you know, the success of musicians through that record company. Can you tell us a little bit about Ajax Records and how that impacted certain
It lasted only for 5 years because it moved to Chicago and New York, and because the Black population in Montreal wasn't big enough to cater to the record company.
Okay.
And so they went through the many distributions of American companies. Ajax Records is one of them. I forgot the name of the other one, but that's good that we know that. And it continued for a while, but it didn't last that long. Fletcher Anderson, even Jack Johnson, the boxer, was part of that. They recorded a Jack Johnson boxing match that's really well known on Ajax Records. And the most famous one was Lou Hooper. But it's really hard to find Lou Hooper stuff. There's a book that just came out.
Okay.
Dorothy Williams and a few other people decided to write about it so they can tell the history of Lou Hooper, and which is prominent and legit.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about Lou Hooper.
He was He was pretty much the mentor for Lou Oscar Peterson.
Oh.
And also Art Tatum was one of his favorites.
Mm-hmm.
And so for Oscar Peterson also, Art Tatum was also Oscar Peterson's favorite pianist. And the reason why is because they're so ambidextrous. They could use both their fingers and their hands and stride along the piano like it was nothing.
Wow.
Have you ever seen Oscar Peterson play?
Not live, no, yeah, unfortunately, but I've seen videos.
Yeah.
But that's pretty,
well, that's good enough.
Yeah.
If you saw the videos, you've seen it.
Yeah.
Because people are still practicing trying to be like that.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, just...
And he's a black African-Canadian.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is amazing.
Yeah, and there's been so many beautiful murals, but there's just something different about seeing somebody live playing, right? Or just seeing, because it's a full body experience, right? And when you see somebody, I know that just for visual arts, but also I love all of the arts, right? And when you see somebody just get into the swing and groove, they go on a different plane, right? Mm. And they're the way that they move, you can tell that they're in sync with the music. The music is part becoming the part of the rhythm of them. That's part of their system. That's part of their ecosystem now. And then that's synergetic. It hops to the next person and the next person. And then we all become interconnected to each other. There's a really interesting artist called Yayoi Kusama, and you know, she's got her dot exhibit series, and that we are all dots. So when you're talking about music and connectivism and this, you know, just watching Oscar Peterson go with his fingers on that piano, for me that's how it links. Like, we're all dots, we're all music, we're all ecosystems, and we sync with each other, and then that creates a story because we're in conversation through rhythm and tune and visuals.
And now that you mention that, a lot of jazz musicians like Miles Davis or Jimi Hendrix, who's a rock musician, or blues musician, they all deal with synesthesia.
Yeah.
Which is very interesting also, by using colors to insinuate what they're doing, and which is really important to music nowadays. And we see that with a lot of musicians nowadays. They don't play with notations. They just play with colors and sound and images.
Especially with a lot of the technology that we have access to now, and like sandbox technologies and AI art and things like that, or VR realities. There was actually, I remember that interesting exhibit you did at the Phi Center, right?
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that project that you did at Phi?
Well, they got me to open up for a well-known musician and artist named Stan Douglas.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to talk about all my favorite musicians. And it was really surprising for some people because they didn't think I would talk about Mahler. And Mahler was, to me, was crazy compared to Beethoven or Liszt or any classical people you think of. Because he actually structured the music to give it a jazz feel. So I spoke about all that. And people were just getting really into it and putting their hands up. And, you know, it was a full house. It was probably about, sold out. It was a full house. And I got to talk about all that. And Stan Douglas, who was in the audience, was really impressed with that. And we continued talking about maybe I can do another discussion on it. But it never came to the end of a pan. It never panned out. But it's okay. It's okay.
But we hear it now, you know, we hear it now. And I remember when you were talking about me about this, we were discussing, you know, how classical music, we don't think of, especially in the Black diaspora, as classical music.
Right.
So, you know, what do you want people to consider or think about when we think of classical music and the linkages to blackness?
You just said it. It's good. There's a lot of black influences that we don't talk about that are really well-known classical musicians in Montreal. And one of them is Brandon Lewis. It lives in Montreal, lives in Little Burgundy from Montreal. Mm-hmm. And he's part of a group called Oboro.
Yeah, you started Oboro.
Yeah, so he's put all these musicians together, and I'm trying to put a project together to create that big entourage of black mm-hmm. musicians. Because I think it would be mind-boggling to see all these black musicians, and people don't even talk about black musicians in Glasgow.
Very, very solid point.
Yeah.
Even I don't see as many as I would like to see sometimes in programming.
They talk about opera.
Right, yeah.
Opera and stuff, but not classical.
And so, you know, you mentioned Oboro. What is Oboro? What's like your dream project in regards to, you know, classical black representation and whatnot?
Well, just bringing all those people together mm-hmm. and making sure that people understand that it's part of the process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like how jazz is part of the process. Yeah. Classical is also part of the process. Just music in general.
Nice. And how would like that session unfold? Like you want it to be community-based discussions? Are you?
I'd love to see workshops. I'd love to see a few concerts if it's possible.
Uh-huh.
And I'm trying to put a grant together that could actually bring that across, because I think it would be mind-boggling for people to see that and start listening.
And do you want people to like jump in and also like, is it a where the audience helps curate, or are
sure,
you looking to collaborate with, are you working to collaborate with other people from the diaspora beyond Montreal, or just solely in Montreal?
Yes, well, there's a big group in Ottawa
mm-hmm.
that's pretty well known.
Okay.
There's people from New Brunswick, but I don't know anything about the people from New Brunswick. I'm just focusing on Montreal.
Nice.
That's what I want to do.
Nice.
Because it shows that there's a lot of, you know, born and raised Canadians.
I totally agree with that. Prior to meeting you, I didn't know a lot of these musicians existed. I didn't even, you know, consider, you know, I kind of considered, you know, in terms of my identity, of like being half Indian, how certain Indian beats and rhythms definitely influenced the Western world and instruments and whatnot.
We could talk about that too. Because Ishad Khan is amazing, who's part of the Khan family in Civilization. And he's from Toronto.
Yeah.
And that needs to be discussed even more. Too.
Well, you know,
there's so many things to be discussed.
I mean, strings, right, from the sitar and the tar, and I mean, those are also in Middle Eastern music as well. So we really are all interconnected music-wise and in the arts, and that's, I think, the beauty, and I think why the arts tend to get attacked first a lot of the times, or people fail to see the importance of the arts, is that it brings meaning and it brings body to us as a people.
What's interesting lately is that since COVID, I was just doing shows for the longest time, for probably 43 years. And all of a sudden, I'm like, why don't I produce my own shows?
Yeah.
So I just started producing my own shows last year.
Mm-hmm.
And so now, next month, I've got Bazzini Quartet, which is really big in Canada, but they're from Montreal. And trying to bring that together at a studio. Maybe we can bring them here at CJLO to spread the word around and get people out more. Stephanie Bazzini is a neighbor of mine across the street, and her crew is incredible.
As incredible as you.
No, I'm better.
Nah, yeah. You're being too bashful.
Yeah. I just started playing the cello, but I'm doing it my own way, like, you know. As we talk about synesthesia, you know, so I can do my A's and my D's and my G's, and just learning certain notations so I can put it all together and make it really rhythmical. And I'm just learning that now.
It sounds like there's a lot of emotionality that comes across through the music, but also your link to not just yourself, but the people. You talk, and I've noticed this a lot with interactions with you. It's your community is just very key to you. Yeah. And I think that's the beauty of the arts and music, visuals, theater, is that it's a way for us to see our shared humanity. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about another project that we've been talking extensively about, which is your jamboree that you wanted to come up with. But I think that we talked a little bit about how you wanted to connect individuals back through that jamboree music. Art Tatum was somebody that you talked about earlier, and I want to kind of go back a little bit to Art Tatum and how he's influenced a lot of your music process.
Well, he's a study on his own, because I'm not sure if you guys know about this, but there's masterpieces done with Art Tatum. Volume 1 to Volume 10.
Uh-huh.
And you can buy them. It's on Verve Records. And
you mix a lot with some of that music?
Not when I'm DJing, but when I'm doing just pure radio.
Okay.
Yeah, yes.
Nice.
Absolutely. I cannot miss him out. He's idolized by Lou Hooper. Well, Lou Hooper is idolized by him, sorry. But Oscar Peterson and Lou Hooper learned from Art Tatum.
So I know we're for sure going to see Art Tatum come up in that jamboree that we're going to talk about in just a moment. But how about we give a little listen to some groovy Art Tatum music first, just to get a feel for it.
And his fingers.
Yeah. Thank you.
mark your calendars for an exciting new event from Crossover Comics. Award-winning comic book author Ryan North will be launching his new book, Marvel Comics, One World Under Doom, Number One. You may know Ryan North from many of his other works, including The Unbeatable Squirrel Girl, Danger and Other Unknown Risks, and the Adventure Time and Star Trek Lower Decks comics, not to mention the legendary Dinosaur comics. The event will take place on February 12th from 4 to 7 p.m. at Crossover Comics, located at 3560 Rue Notre Dame West in Saint-Henri. Fans will also have the opportunity to meet the author, get their comics and books signed, and have a chat with him about his work. For more information, visit us in store or contact us at 514-284-7373.
Listen to Madonna Talk on CJLO 1690 AM, Saturdays 4 p.m. to 5 p.m., hosted by Kamala Madantalk-Wright, an introduction to revolutionary reggae consciousness and the Caribbean indigenous community. Maroons, Caramanti, Kumina, Caribs, Taino, and Rastafarian culture, issues affecting the BIPOC community.
Give it to me straight, Doc. How long do I have?
Well, thanks to the miracles of modern medicine, we seem to have found a cure for literally all of your symptoms.
Even a cure for my boredom with traditional radio formats? Tell me, Doc, what's the cure?
Just listen to CJLO 1690 AM online or through your radio every day.
Wowza, I feel better already.
And we are back. Thank you so much, Andy, for being here. Thank you so much to all you folks tuning in and listening in on this educational series and just getting to know more about Andy's work. So, Andy, that jamboree we were talking about, I love community work. I love things that are going to connect especially kids, the general public, families through the arts. And when we've spoken about this, that's what the jamboree is. So tell us about this jamboree.
So I wanted to start off this jamboree because I started playing music with all these different people and have different environments set up for it. And what I wanted to do, this is during COVID. So many things happened during COVID.
A lot of creative juices flowing.
Yeah. So... During COVID, I realized people don't really want to play or perform or DJ at 10 o'clock at night or 12 o'clock at night. Why not have in afternoon concerts and afternoon gigs? Mm-hmm. So I came up with the word Afternoon Delight, which is how the jamboree started. So we started getting groups out of... Kennecal Tropical, Jazz MC Sound System, Taboo, Tambua, and all these different groups coming out to actually give their respects to the music in Montreal and music in general. And it wasn't just jazz, it was Latin music and music from the West Indian diaspora. And so I thought about it, and so I made up a list of different DJs I'd like to have in this jamboree. Mm. But it became really lengthy, and I thought to myself, how can I get a grant for this? It's going to be 50 people. Then I realized, speaking to Kiara, you don't need 50 people. You just need a small amount of people.
Yeah.
So I started thinking about it. So I figured I might as well choose the top 10 people that I want, and that would create a big audience by just having those people involved.
Yeah, and I mean, those 50, they're going to be in there in the future. They're going to work with you in the future iterations. Yeah. We're going to make that happen, right?
Right.
So it sounds like, you know, this Jamboree project, it's really something that's aiming to connect the Black diaspora community. Black diasporic music, which is something that we were talking...
But that's the thing.
Okay.
It wasn't just the Black diaspora. It was, my French DJ friends, my Indian DJ friends, my...
Oh, yeah. So it's an it's an international, multicultural thing.
Yeah, so,
I like that. Yeah. I like that.
So that's how that came across.
Yeah, and kind of showing all the influences of non-Western music showcased.
Mm.
So it feels like as if it speaks Montreal.
Right.
Because, I mean, I think that's the beauty of Montreal is that we're just a multi-ethnic hub,
right.
Especially. We're connected through very diverse points of musicality and artistry. Would this unfold, you said Afternoon Delights, so it'd be kind of afternoon jam sessions, a little bit like block parties?
Sort of.
So that, you know, public can kind of... jazz together, dance together, and connect.
Yeah.
And, you know, in terms of reconnecting to music, I think this ties back to what we were talking about at the beginning of there's a lot of diversity that's been lost, I think, through just having certain curated types of music, or we don't always think about the worldwide influences of music in our experiences today, and of it being a community-based connection, and it being a conversation between each other. So I'm excited to see this project unfold. What would be the things that you're needing right now? Who do you need?
Money.
Yeah.
Money to just kick it off.
Yeah.
And it's always like that.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm guessing that there's certain collaborators that, I mean, we've been both working together, I think, to try to get this to happen and whatnot. And it's something that we want to see the city, the value that this brings to the city, not just in the French-speaking community, but also English.
People are like the people I know and... Mm-hmm. A lot of the people, they're ready to do it. Mm-hmm. Not only that, I want to incorporate different types of things like yoga, qigong, tai chi, in the mix of all that.
I dig that. You know, it's like you said, community. It's about movement. It's also about interweaving all of these experiences together to really make a community-based approach. To interacting with music and body, synesthesia, right? Thank you so much for being around today. I wish we could talk for another hour about the Jamboree, about your involvement with Jazz Amnesty, with Obero, with all the amazing projects you've done. Thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in with us. If you're interested in collaborating or learning more about Andy's work, where can we contact you? Where can we find you?
My website, biafrablue.com.
Okay.
Biafrablue.com.
Biafrablue.com. Awesome. And you can also follow Andy Williams online on Facebook and on Instagram.
Yeah, not only that, with biafrablue.com, you can actually see the curriculum I wrote for my master's, my first master's, which was done at Goddard College in Vermont. I was using music as an educational tool. Then it became my second master's at Concordia, was about connectivism and all that stuff. So, yeah, once you open it, it will tell you, it will show you everything.
All right, cool. Thank you so much, Andy. We hope to hear from you folks. Thank you for being here and sharing this space with us. And closing it off with a little bit of Oliver Jones. You have a nourishing day.